The idea of producing electric power without coal mines or nuclear plants has been a dream of some environmentalists, but the visual representation of what some of them support as replacement power sources is just as disturbing to other people, especially residents and some business enterprises which line the shores of the Great Lakes. We're talking today about wind farms on the water, turbines that would produce power but reach hundreds of feet high from their man-made bases along the bottom of Lake Erie. I'm Rick Jackson. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. The now decade-long battle lies in whether pastimes such as boating and fishing, scenery such as a pristine horizon, or safety over airborne and aquatic life outweigh the future demand for the power we need to run our homes and buildings. We'll converse with a reporter who's been involved in covering similar ongoing wind farm battles in Michigan. Then we'll talk with Beju Shah of the Greater Cleveland Partnership, which tomorrow hosts a sustainability conference designed to help large businesses, small businesses, and entrepreneurs. It all gets started right after national and local news. It is The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us this Monday. The proposed wind turbine farm in Lake Erie, known as the Icebreaker Project, has been a hot-button issue since it was birthed more than a decade ago. As a quick refresher on this complex story, Icebreaker would be the first freshwater wind farm in North America. It's a pilot project made up of just six turbines placed 8 to 10 miles offshore in Lake Erie. The project recently cleared a major hurdle following a 6-1 decision from the state Supreme Court, which ruled the project could move forward. It had been hung up in a legal battle since 2021. There are a multitude of mixed feelings about the development of wind power in the Great Lakes, with concerns remaining about the impact on wildlife, as well as the effects on tourism and shoreline communities. Those feelings are not relegated to here in Northeast Ohio, where Icebreaker is being discussed, actually stretching along the Great Lakes region. Citizens from Buffalo to Chicago to Traverse City and Green Bay have been paying attention to the development of wind power in the lakes. Today on the program, we'll discuss the issue with an environmental reporter from Northern Michigan. Later in the hour, I'll chat with Beju Shah from the Greater Cleveland Partnership about a summit that's happening tomorrow, helping companies with their sustainability goals. But first off, let's discuss the latest in the development of offshore wind power. Joining me is Patrick Shea. He's an environmental reporter for Interlochen Public Radio and just covered the topic for the Points North podcast. Patrick, welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Folks, if you'd like to join our conversation, the number to call, toll-free, 866-578-0903, locally 216-578-0903. Email us, SOI at ideastream.org. You may tweet us, we're at Sound of Ideas. You can text us, 216-916-6478. And Patrick, before we get to the potential for offshore projects, where do we see wind power right now in Michigan? Update us in terms of, you know, being a regional neighbor, is there an appetite for the renewal where you are, renewables, as there is here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of states in the region, Michigan included, have set some pretty ambitious climate goals. Michigan wants to be net zero with its carbon emissions by 2050. A big part of reaching that goal could be renewable energies, and there has been a lot of development in wind energy, but we're mostly seeing it, well, entirely seeing it, onshore. There was a feasibility study here in Michigan about the potential for offshore wind energy, and there's a lot of potential there, to put it simply, but like a lot of other areas, Michigan has faced some pushback due to aesthetic concerns, wildlife, and some other things you've mentioned. So despite lots of research into the potential for offshore wind, we haven't seen any here in Michigan. And like you said, the Icebreaker Project will be the first of its kind in the whole Great Lakes region.
What kind of debates do we hear over the land wind in Michigan? I mean, it's not just the water that people are fighting over.
Yeah, so there have been more developments in onshore wind energy, and any time that any of these projects are proposed, obviously there are concerns from people in that area. So a lot of the wind energy producers I talked with spoke about the importance of working with local communities, providing incentives as a form of tax income for these municipalities, but also giving people a say in how these turbines are going to look, where they're going to be placed, and the aesthetics of them, even down to the shade of white that they use on certain turbines. I met with a guy from Consumers Energy here in Michigan who told me that members of the township where their wind farm is located got together and looked at a palette of options of white and landed on a very specific eggshell white that you won't see on any other turbines anyway. So even down to the littlest details, it really matters to people what they're seeing go up in their community, what kind of benefit it's going to provide. And yeah, there's always some hesitation at first, and it takes a while to get people on board with these sort of projects. Mm-hmm.
Here in this part of the state, I can think of maybe 5 or 6 turbines that are in Cuyahoga County scattered. But you go out in western Ohio, northwestern, there are hundreds of turbines on essentially wind farms. Is it there a concentration in Michigan as well, a certain place where land wind power is developed?
Yeah, well, I think anyone that lives near the shores of the Great Lakes know that those are very windy places. We have a lot of winds coming from the west across Lake Michigan, especially in the late fall and winter months. So that's obviously a site that's prime. There are a few locations near the lakeshore, but here in Michigan, also kind of in the center of the northern part of the state, has become a focal point. We have Lake Huron on the east and Michigan on the west, and in the middle is sort of a ridge of high ground between those two drainage basins. And largely due to the pushback about turbines near the lakeshore in the lake, that area has seen a lot of focus in recent history for wind development in Michigan.
Who are the main players you see regarding this debate in Michigan?
Well, when it comes to turbines on the lake, lakeshore property owners have a lot of sway. More than 10 years ago, there was a project proposed for Western Michigan in the water, a Scandinavian company, not too different from the Icebreaker project. That got shut down pretty quick. One person I spoke with was the former head of energy for the state of Michigan, and he told me that, you know, lakeshore property owners often are from out of state, either whether they live in Chicago or a Michigan residence, that's some of the most valuable property available in the region. And these people tend to have, you know, a lot of interest in maintaining an aesthetic in their region, but also they have, you know, the resources at their disposal to push back against these projects in court, which is exactly what we've seen so far.
You just touched on what is a hot-button issue for a lot of people. Got an email actually this morning already from Pat that says, quote, "Wealthy people who live on the lake in their private enclaves are more worried about aesthetics of offshore wind than anything else. They don't understand anything except their own money." Is that a comment that would ring true with the battles you're reporting on?
I think that's only part of the story. I think there's definitely aesthetic concerns that should be taken into account. It's one thing to have these on land, but it's another thing to kind of impact the view on the horizon. And that doesn't just impact someone's individual view, but could have an impact on tourism. In the podcast episode, we look at some studies from other parts of the country about the impacts of offshore wind on whether or not people want to return to the same places for their vacation and things like that. So there's the tourism concern, and then also conservation concerns. When it comes down to it, we don't have evidence that wind turbines really do kill more birds than another structure that would be standing in the way, but it is another structure, and the Great Lakes are migratory paths for birds. So the concerns are definitely still there when it comes to the impact of offshore wind turbines in the Great Lakes on migratory birds, simply because it's never been done, and we're not going to know the real impact until these are in the water.
Right. Patrick, I'm going to go to the phone lines a little earlier than we usually do here. Folks, if you want to call in, it's 866-578-0903. Let's start with Danny, who's calling in from the west side of Cleveland. Good morning. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas, Danny.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. You answered some of the questions. I'm just curious, would this be considered clean energy? And I thought at one time it wasn't really worth the buck to do it. Now it seems like technology has caught up and that it may be well worthwhile. And how far out are they, like, from landowners? And I think that's it. Go ahead.
Okay, Patrick, yeah, go ahead and take the first part of that first, the expense of it.
Yeah, so the expense of it has been a barrier, and kind of leads me into an interesting development that recently happened. In New York, they were looking into the feasibility of these wind turbines in Lake Erie. There's been a lot of pushback in that state from citizen organizers who don't want to see them in the lake. And New York actually recently decided it wasn't worth it from an economic perspective. Offshore wind turbines are going to have a higher upfront cost for putting them in the water. And it's a relatively new technology, so there's not as much competition in the market. The companies building these are generally Scandinavian companies. In the case of the Icebreaker project, it's a Norwegian company, Fred Olsen Renewables. And New York State kind of made the argument that if we focus on onshore wind with the technology that's a little more advanced and further along, the upfront costs will be lower, and in the long run, more bang for your buck in terms of reaching climate goals. So there is an economic barrier that some people feel doesn't make these projects worth it. But again, this one in Cleveland should be a test run to see how much of a benefit there will really be compared to the cost of the project.
And when you say test run, we're really looking at 6 windmills actually out there, whereas if we were putting up a farm, it would be much, much more.
Right. Six wind turbines with the capacity to generate 20 megawatts of power at peak operating capacity. If you compare that to Cleveland's public power system, that has 300 megawatts of power. So it's not a huge, huge dent in the city's grid, even at peak operation points, but it will have an impact, and time could tell what that impact will be as far as generating renewable energy in Cleveland.
Right. You're talking about 7%. That's not a lot, but it is helpful. Let's go back to the phone lines where Jim is on the phone, also from Cleveland. Jim, welcome.
Yeah, I got to say, I find the hypocrisy of those that are against wind, especially as someone who's a birder myself, knowing what this could do to the migratory pathway of birds. Yes, it's something we have to deal with, but I would ask the people in northeastern Ohio that are opposed to this thing, if they're opposed to what's been happening to southeast Ohio in the name of coal mining in the past, fracking in the present, and all that kind of stuff. What we've done to southeast Ohio in the name of fossil fuels is devastating, and northeast Ohio never thinks about that. So, a couple wind turbines, I think it's the least we could do up here in northeast Ohio to put some skin in the game as far as energy diversity is concerned. And then the other thing that has to be said is, as we saw with Cape Wind, a lot of this stuff is really just NIMBY stuff. It's people that have a lot of resources, a lot of lawyers, and they can frame it any way they want. But I would just caution everyone here in northeast Ohio, take a trip down to southeast Ohio, see what we've done down there, and then see if a couple wind turbines isn't so bad. So,
thank you for that, Jim. Yeah, the idea, Patrick, of sharing the sacrifice, is that something that's come up in Michigan as well? Maybe the fracking isn't the big issue there. But, yeah, people don't think that one part of the state should carry the burden for all.
Sure, sure. And even in Ohio, some people I've spoken with don't, they're not opposed necessarily to wind energy as a whole. They just think those resources might be better spent onshore where we could develop more turbines for the same cost. And again, when the issues of birds comes up, in terms of fossil fuels, the Audubon Society has actually voiced its support. The National Audubon Society supports the Icebreaker Wind Project. It points out that over 400 species of North American birds are threatened by the impacts of a warming climate, and that the more renewable energy we can generate can help curb some of these effects of climate change that birds are facing. So while there could be an impact to birds, the Audubon Society at least makes the case that, you know, continuing down the path of fossil fuel dependence also has an impact on a lot of bird species in the region.
I mentioned earlier that our state Supreme Court had weighed in last August on a lawsuit that had started back in 21. What's the political climate like in Michigan? Is there a faction in the legislature that's fighting for, fighting against?
Well, I mentioned that project about 10 years ago that got shot down pretty quick. Despite doing a really intensive study on the potential for offshore wind energy in Michigan a decade ago, we still haven't seen any other projects since then really gain any steam or be talked about. It seems like in Michigan, the wind energy efforts have been pushed further inland to that in-between Lake Huron and Michigan area that I mentioned. Not as much talk since that original project proposed 10 years ago here in Michigan. But the Icebreaker project could be something that other states look at and see how successful it is and how much it ends up costing in the end.
Where does Governor Whitmer come down on this?
To my knowledge, Governor Whitmer hasn't spoken specifically about offshore wind energy. Her climate plan for the state, like I said, does have a goal of net carbon neutrality by 2050. It's a really ambitious goal that a lot of states have similar goals they share. So that'll take almost anything we can get. And there's definitely a lot of potential for offshore wind in the Great Lakes. But again, the issue hasn't come up here in a really concrete way since that initial proposal 10 years ago.
We were talking about how Interlochen Radio does a lot of coverage. It's not just there in northern Michigan, and we've been talking Michigan and Ohio, but there are seven Great Lakes states and provinces. Have you reached out further?
Sorry, lost you there for just a second. Yeah, I have spoken with people kind of around the area, and specifically some of the biggest debates right now were in New York near the shores of Lake Erie and of Lake Ontario. And in that case, again, like I said, a lot of people were very concerned that this feasibility study going on there was going to greenlight a lot of proposed projects in Lake Erie and Ontario and New York. In fact, Citizens Against Wind Turbines in Lake Erie is a New York-based group I spoke with. They were pretty sure that this feasibility study was going to be, in their mind, the beginning of the end. We were going to see lots of wind turbines in the lakes. But again, kind of a surprise decision that the New York Department of Energy came away with. They said that Great Lakes wind currently does not offer a unique, critical, or cost-effective contribution to renewable energy beyond the technologies that are already in place in New York. And it seems they want to focus their efforts inland on solar and wind instead of trying to break ground into this new area of offshore wind, again, with those higher upfront costs and less competition in the market.
It is interesting. We know that certainly People are paying attention. I got an email from Susan here talking about the Ohio legislature. House Bill 6 that we had here reduced energy standards and setbacks for wind turbines, hurt development of wind turbines. Are you seeing a Republican-Democratic split in Michigan or in New York or in Illinois, as we've seen here?
Well, again, at least here in Michigan and in most of the areas I've looked, there haven't really been offshore projects like this proposed. Wind energy has played a big role in meeting energy goals in Michigan, and I haven't heard a lot of strong pushback against the onshore wind that we currently have. I think if the conversation of developing turbines in the lake comes up again, that'll be a pretty divisive issue, and I haven't really seen it fall along party lines, to be honest. Like I said, I've spoken with many people who are all for wind energy. They just don't think the waters of the Great Lakes are the right place for it.
Got a couple of more emails and callers that wanted to talk about the aesthetics of it all. Mark, for instance, couldn't stay on the line, but says it seems like all the problems here and in other countries come from people living near the lakeshore that don't want to look at it. But to go on, let's look at the technology of it. Scott's on the line from Oberlin. Scott, good morning. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas. You're talking with Patrick Shea. What's up?
Hey, folks. How do you do, Patrick? Welcome to Cleveland. Right now, I'm looking at an app that I have on my phone. It's called electricitymap.org, and I'm looking at the Midwest, the Mid-Continent Independent Transmission System Operator Grid and the production of wind. Now, there's a potential of 30 gigawatts of electricity generation from wind in that zone of electrical production. And that includes nuclear, coal, solar, hydro, battery storage, and gas. But as far as wind right now, it's only generating about 5 gigawatts of that 30 gigawatts potential. So when I hear people talking about wind, it's always about the potential of wind, but it doesn't really talk about the production reality. Now, when I go to, over the past 30 days, I'm seeing about the same ratio. It looks like about 5 gigawatts to 30 gigawatts. But over the last 12 months, then it gets closer to about one-third.
Scott, is there a question coming? Thank you for the info, though. That's good. But is there a question coming?
Wind generation is always about the potential of it and everything, but it's not really about the production. And when we're talking about needing electricity to keep the pumps going, to keep the hospitals going, to keep the traffic lights, and just everything that we depend on for electricity, it doesn't do it. It's a way to farm potential electricity.
Okay.
So my question...
Go ahead.
Is what is the reality? It's like the reality is that wind just doesn't generate. If we're going to replace 300 megawatts of Cleveland electricity with just wind, that would mean 90 hours.
Right. Scott, thank you. Yeah, a lot of information there, Patrick. Have you looked at the future, what it might take, as Scott was asking, what it might take to replace entire power grids?
Well, I think that the idea of replacing entire power grids with wind isn't really the reality of what's being pushed and what's on the table. You know, wind energy depends on the wind blowing, which there are times of the year in the Great Lakes when that's an abundant resource, but there are times when the wind is less active. I think I spoke with one wind farm who said the winds have to be 7 miles per hour for them to start spinning, which isn't super strong winds, but again, it's not going to be all the time. But as far as the potential goes, yes, right now wind isn't providing, it's not carrying, you know, the majority of the weight for, you know, supplying that grid,
right,
that you talked about in the middle of the continent. But the potential for offshore wind is huge. It depends on developing it. That's a big if. But a study from a few years ago found that in some of the Great Lakes states, offshore wind is a huge resource. And if we, you know, capitalized on it as much as possible, there could be almost a third of Wisconsin's energy met by offshore wind. And in Michigan, the potential there out in the water is closer to two-thirds of the entire grid. Now, that's a really high number for if we developed everywhere we possibly could, which probably isn't going to happen for a variety of the reasons we've discussed. But there is, in short, a lot of wind available in the Great Lakes and in a unique way to this region.
And I'm sure naysayers would say right away, well, Wisconsin doesn't have the population of Ohio or Pennsylvania. But yeah, the point is well taken. Hey, before you go, I know that you have a lot more going on with Points North. What angles of the story are you going to be developing?
Well, it's something I definitely want to follow. I mean, I'd like to see what happens with the Icebreaker Wind project as it develops, and in general, renewable energy in the Great Lakes is a really interesting thing to follow as a natural resources or environmental reporter, because again, all these states have set very, very ambitious climate goals in our region, and to see if those are, you know, talk or a reality, we're going to have to see some more development, because like the last caller mentioned, right now it's not supplying the proportion of the grid needed to meet those goals. So the next few years really, really will tell if those goals are realistic, or, you know, if it's going to take longer than we've planned.
Okay. We will subscribe to your podcast and pay attention to what you're saying. Patrick Shea is lead producer for Points North, a narrative podcast about the land, water, and inhabitants of the Great Lakes. You can find Points North wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you so much for taking time today, Patrick.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick.
You can hear his full story on the possibility of offshore wind energy in the Great Lakes at pointsnorthpodcast.org. We'll put a link on our site as well. Right now, though, we're going to take about 5 minutes and play an excerpt of that podcast. So here's Patrick Shea and Daniel Washira on Points North.
A report last year looked at expected electricity demands by 2050. Using data from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, it found that in Wisconsin, there's enough offshore wind to provide almost 30% of that demand. And in Michigan, it's closer to two-thirds.
Two-thirds. Wow, that is a lot of energy. So, again, why isn't anybody capturing it? Why no turbines in the lakes?
Well, they could be coming soon. The first ever offshore wind project in the Great Lakes was officially approved this summer. It would be the first of its kind, 6 turbines located about 8 miles from Cleveland, right in the waters of Lake Erie. It's called the Icebreaker Wind Project, and it could pave the way for more wind turbines in the Great Lakes. But that's the last thing some people want to hear.
Mark my word, once they put one in the water, it will just continue on and on and on until our lake is, all the lakes are filled. They're not going to stop.
Sharon Trembath is from Evans, New York, about 20 miles south of Buffalo. She says she's been defending Lake Erie for most of her life.
I'm 77. When I was 16, my brothers and I helped stop the gill nets in Lake Erie. I've worked on the pharmaceuticals being dumped into the lake. I've worked on phosphates. We fought Procter & Gamble back in 1989.
For Sharon, protecting the lake doesn't just mean trying to stop things from happening. It's hands-on, too.
For the past 40 years, I've been the Lake Erie coordinator for the International Coastal Cleanup. I have 2,000 volunteers from Presque Isle, Pennsylvania, up to Niagara Falls, who clean up the shoreline every year. I call it the Great Lakes Beach Sweep. Okay, that's my life.
Sharon says all that activism comes from her lifelong relationship with the lake. She says living near Lake Erie has given her a deeper appreciation for the natural world.
I live about 500 feet from the shoreline. Today, it's perfectly calm. It's absolutely beautiful. It matches any Caribbean place I've ever been to. Tomorrow, Lake Erie can kick up in a minute. It's the shallowest of the Great Lakes, so it can kick up to an amazing storm.
Sharon loves looking out at the lake in any weather, and she enjoys seeing it change. But now, there's another change she doesn't like seeing.
One thing that's really aggravating, we can see the turbines over in Canada. Lake Erie, where I live, there's a 20-mile span from Sturgeon Point to Port Abino. And when we look out at night, we can see the red blinking lights, and it looks like Christmas lights. And every year there's more and more and more. I don't find them pretty or majestic at all. I find them ugly and industrial.
Those turbines are on the Canadian shoreline, but Sharon's fighting to keep them out of the lake. She's part of a group called Citizens Against Wind Turbines in Lake Erie. She says a company called Diamond Offshore Wind approached her town's government 3 years ago. It wanted to build 50 turbines in the lake. Nothing's been officially proposed yet, but Sharon's group is trying to get ahead of it by stirring up opposition.
Thank heavens for Facebook, because right now we have close to 5,000 numbers. In the past month, we've had, I think, 54,000 people look at our website. Our focus is educating the public that this is their lake. And we're asking people to call and write their elected officials and let them know how they feel. Whatever your passion is, you tell your elected official why you, in your words, don't want them in the lake.
There are plenty of reasons people don't want these turbines, but the way they look is a big one. And some say the visual impacts are more than just aesthetics.
Lake Erie tourism creates about 150,000 jobs.
John LaPai is on the board of the Lake Erie Foundation. It's an environmental nonprofit that fights harmful algal blooms, microplastics, and now the Icebreaker Wind Project.
One of our concerns is that you have people who come to Lake Erie for their vacations, and if you start planting wind turbines offshore, ruining those views, how is that going to affect those actual jobs?
A study from North Carolina State University asked that same question. Researchers surveyed tourists at popular beaches about how wind turbines in the water would affect their experience. 80% of respondents said they either wouldn't come back to the same spot for vacation, or they'd expect an unrealistic price drop to make it worth their while. LaPai says the same could be true for Ohio.
Sandusky and the Lake Erie Islands, Cedar Point, all those places along the lake are dependent upon Lake Erie for tourists. So that was a pretty telling study for us in terms of vacationers' attitudes.
Now, the Icebreaker Wind Project has been approved, but the Lake Erie Foundation is still trying a long-shot legal effort to stop it. They've joined forces with two bird conservation groups and filed a federal lawsuit against the government agencies that approved the project. But there's no guarantee they'll get a hearing. And that brings us to birds. Some people are worried the turbines could kill migratory birds flying over Lake Erie. But the National Audubon Society has actually voiced its support for the Icebreaker project. It says almost 400 species of North American birds are threatened by a warming climate, and that wind energy could help limit that warming. But when it comes down to it, it's hard to say exactly what the impact will be on birds before the wind turbines are actually in the lake.
It's The Sound of Ideas. We're featuring some reporting from Interlochen Public Radio about the Icebreaker Wind Project, which if built, would be offshore here in Cleveland. We just heard about some of the opposing views on the project from residents of the Great Lakes. Here's another excerpt, but to be fair, this cut features supporters of the project.
Not everyone who loves the Great Lakes wants to keep them turbine-free. Like Sharon Trembath and John LaPai, Jade Davis has spent most of his life near Lake Erie.
So I was born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, actually. So I definitely understand that, you know, aesthetics and the relationship people have with the Great Lakes are real things to take into context. I think everyone involved understands that.
Jade is one of those involved. He's with the Port of Cleveland, a government agency overseeing the Icebreaker project.
This project was designed to mitigate those aesthetic issues from the jump with the placement of the turbines and things like that. You'll need a clear day and have to actually be looking directly or be in a building really, really high up in Cleveland to even see the tops of them and the tips of them in the faint distance. Because, I mean, you're talking 8 miles. And so it's not going to be like riding down the street and it's just going to be a bunch of turbines there.
The 6 turbines will be able to generate a little over 20 megawatts of power during peak production. To put that into context, the Cleveland public power system is about 300 megawatts. So these initial turbines won't provide a huge portion of the city's electricity, but Jade says it's a test run.
People say, well, how come you're only doing 6? How come you're not doing 60 or 600? Well, let's make sure we can do this right. Let's make sure we can do this safely environmentally and create real sustainable renewable power now at this level, and then we can go back and look at, all right, is this right for the Great Lakes? Is this right for a certain portion of the Great Lakes and not other portions? Where, how, all these kind of things. That's what Icebreaker Wind Project will solve for.
Jade says this project has been a long time coming. It was first discussed in the early 2000s, then officially proposed about 10 years ago. But it faced legal opposition, especially from lakeshore residents and boaters. It wasn't until August of this year that the Ohio Supreme Court finally gave the project the official go-ahead.
I personally am just excited to see the real push towards innovation and then also the opportunity to create a hub here in Northeast Ohio for onshore and offshore wind and technologies. We have the people, we have the logistics, and so why not here?
Those are excerpts from a podcast of Interlochen Public Radio, which has long been following the battles of wind farms in the water, as have so many people here in Northeast and Northwestern Ohio. Our thanks again to environmental reporter Patrick Shea for joining us on The Sound of Ideas. If you have further comments on the wind farm, reach out through our last word line. I see some of you already have since we entered the conversation with Patrick. That is soi@ideastream.org. We're going to take a quick break now. On the other side, we preview an event being held tomorrow in Cleveland aiming to foster sustainability among companies large and small. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Rick Jackson. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Sustainability has become one of those words used so often that its meaning has arguably become muddled. It's a term attached to just about anything like food or manufactured items such as clothing or hygienic products. Companies, large and small, are concerning themselves with this term as well and how it applies to their business practices. But what exactly does it mean to be sustainable? How raw materials are sourced? How resources are used? There are even questions as to how workplace culture and benefits create a sustainable environment. A summit meeting here tomorrow in Cleveland's looking to address the issue of sustainability. I recently sat down with Beju Shaw, the CEO of Greater Cleveland Partnership, to discuss the event, with the GCP being the organizer. I began by asking him about ESG goals, which stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance. These goals being discussed in the business world, I wanted Beju Shaw to spell out how that plays into what's happening at tomorrow's summit.
Well, this summit is really focused on the E part of the ESG, the environmental side, and sustainability more specifically as it relates to environmental. These are goals that companies now have that describe the impact that they want to have more broadly than the bottom line on our community as well as on the world.
That specific concept is really becoming more important, I think, to business world.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you look at it in the concept of sustainability, it's not just an opportunity for them to do more good in the world. It's becoming increasingly apparent that it's a growing business opportunity. As we say, going green is enabling companies to get more green as well from a profitability perspective.
We see sustainability not just solely environmental. Do diversity, equity, and inclusion practices kind of play into this whole sustainable mindset?
Well, it certainly does in the broader ESG discussion. The S around social is really often where the initiatives grouped around diversity, equity, and inclusion get bundled. But this summit is really going to focus principally on the environmental focus. We have other initiatives at the Greater Cleveland Partnership that focus on equity and inclusion, including assisting companies as they are pursuing their goals to have more diverse and welcoming environments for individuals of all backgrounds.
When you say diverse and welcoming, does that also include fair and competitive wages? I know some regions pay more than others. Some industries pay more than similar industries.
Well, I think it's a holistic approach. You know, as companies are competing for talent, it's about that entire package. It's the experience that you can offer to individuals who increasingly have the choice to work at your company or at other companies, both within our region as well as outside of our region. So it's what can you do as an employer to make sure that you are providing an environment that is both diverse and welcoming and promoting of individuals from many different backgrounds? How can you make sure that your compensation and your benefits are competitive relative to other offerings, as well as how do you ensure that there's professional development opportunities for individuals to continue to grow in their careers?
Good foundation. Now give us a lay of the land for this summit. What were you hearing from the business community in Northeast Ohio that made the Greater Cleveland Partnership want to host an event like this?
Well, this really starts with our CEOs. You know, as I was talking to our CEOs across the region over the beginning of, let's say, 2022, increasingly sustainability, environmental impact, became a recurring theme as companies were exploring what more they could do, again, not just for the community and the world, but what more could they and should they be doing to explore this trend from a business growth perspective. That led to us convening about 25 sustainability leaders within corporations. These individuals have all sorts of different titles. Some are called chief sustainability officers, others are head of environmental, and you get the picture. But we started convening them at the beginning of 2022, first to listen more and to learn more about what they are grappling with inside their own companies, and also importantly, to connect them to one another. Oftentimes, we find that individuals in these roles might be really well-connected outside of our region, usually within industry networks, but don't necessarily know people that might just be, you know, a couple doors down, so to speak, and certainly could benefit from not just knowing them socially, but learning from each other, because, you know, the banking industry looks at things differently than the insurance, looks at things differently than engineered products and so on. In those discussions, you know, we were guided by these sustainability leaders to think about, well, given the interest of each of these companies and the investments that they were making to become more sustainable enterprises themselves, as well as to pursue new product and service opportunities, what more could we be looking at doing together in the region to realize our vision of a green city or a green region on a blue lake? And from that discussion, one of the initiatives that was born was this summit. Now, this builds on a strong foundation in this region. This is not new to the greater Cleveland area. There's been a history of sustainability efforts that one can trace back through city efforts, through county efforts, through entrepreneurial groups like Entrepreneurs for Sustainability, to, you know, the origins of the environmental movement and Carl Stokes taking a stand that led to the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency at a federal level. So it builds on that tradition. But what's different now is you've got companies that are pursuing this broadly and with significant resources that want to come together and see what can they do to really help propel our region towards that vision of a green region on a blue lake. The summit is the first initiative. And in the summit, the objective is to make sure that as the large companies have shifted their practices and their products and services, and because of that, shifted their expectations for all of their suppliers, they want to make sure that the supply base, our small to medium companies throughout the region, are aware of the new business opportunities and the new business expectations that these large companies have. We strongly believe that as these small to medium-sized enterprises learn more about these shifts, they're going to find not only new business opportunities, but practices that will enable them to be more competitive, not just to serve local companies, but to serve these companies globally. So we think of this as a growth platform for small to medium businesses, as it has been for large companies.
I like that you're bringing a sense of entrepreneurship into this. Are those smaller companies willing to learn from some of the giants? And you have reps from Cleveland's largest companies speaking, Lincoln Electric, Nestle, Eaton, Lubrizol, and the like. It's clear there's buy-in from the top. Is there buy-in from the entrepreneurs coming up?
Well, it's exciting to see some of these smaller companies that have started to emerge, and certainly the response to this summit. We didn't really know what to expect. This is the first time the business community has been hosting the summit. Again, it builds on a tradition in this region that's been hosted by other types of civic and public organizations. But we hit our maximum capacity weeks ahead of this event, and it's because of the demand from small to medium-sized enterprises. So I think that demonstrates the high degree of interest in the small to medium-sized business community about learning what these business opportunities are, learning what these new business requirements may be, so they can continue to grow and remain competitive as enterprises themselves.
You mentioned that you talk to a lot of the CEOs, and you look at it, you know, kind of from the top of the kingdom out at all these places. Do you have a sense of what companies have gotten right when it pertains to sustainability and how they can then help inform other businesses?
Well, you know, there's two different ways to think about that. You know, first, I'll talk about it from the business product opportunities or service opportunities. And one, you know, way that we as consumers all can relate to this is in the vision of an electric vehicle. Well, if you think about electric vehicles in our region, we've got a number of companies that participate in electric vehicles and the charging infrastructure. While you might think of Tesla and GM and Ford as sort of the only players in electric vehicle, you have to remember they need batteries, and that's where companies like Ultium, which is a partnership of both GM and LG in Youngstown, participate. They need components that are specially designed to work in electric vehicles. That's where Parker Hannifin and Eaton, or Rockwell Automation, all participate. They need lightweight steel, given the weight of these batteries. Cleveland-Cliffs happens to be one of Tesla's major business suppliers, and they need different types of tires, and that's where Goodyear has designed tires that participate in enabling electric vehicles to move forward. And then finally, they need charging infrastructure, and that's where companies like Lincoln Electric and Nidec have participated. And that's just to name a few. So from pursuing business opportunities, we see companies, large companies, our members, going headlong into sustainable product opportunities, whether it's around electric vehicles, whether it's around sustainable materials, new manufacturing processes across the board. And of course, we even see this from some of our institutions, not just our research institutions, but places like NASA Glenn that are thinking about this given what their mission is and how they need to enable that mission to go to Moon, to the Mars and back, lots of which requires lots of these same types of technologies. Mm-hmm. Now, the other side of this is, you know, sustainable business operations. This is how you change your production processes, how you change your distribution processes to think more about what we classically think of in terms of sustainability. So if you think of sustainability, again, at the consumer level, all of us sort of grew up with this phrase of reduce, reuse, recycle. Well, take that same mindset of reduce, reuse, recycle into the business process space, and all of our larger companies are starting to look at, you know, how do you reduce the amount of material that you're using? How do you reuse materials by recapturing that somewhere in the value chain? And when you can't reduce or reuse materials, then it's how do we make materials or how do we make our products such that they can be reliably recycled for other uses out there? And the companies, again, the larger companies in our region, have, because of the stakeholder interest in this, started to put forward significant efforts to measure where they are today in their materials usage and their environmental impact, and set aggressive targets for where they want to be in 2030, 2040, 2050. That's what's really exciting, is that we've now got not just statements that are being made by companies of all sizes, but there are measurements against those statements. And once things get measured, as we know, things actually get done. And we're increasingly seeing companies now on an annual basis reporting out on their sustainability or ESG reports, what progress they've made to, in both directions, both in creating more sustainable products that they're selling out to the market, but then also in reducing their business environmental footprint in air, land, and water impact.
One of those statements they have to put out every year is a bottom line. Does the need for profitability intersect well with sustainability and environmental concerns?
I think increasingly so. This is our going green, you know, leads to greater green for a lot of these companies, because their customers on the other side are demanding this. There's something, Rick, that those that are kind of deeply embedded will recognize, that just on air emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, CO2, and other types of greenhouse gases, there's something called scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3 emissions. And we won't get into all of that, but basically what all these companies are now starting to measure, especially in scope 1 and scope 2, is what are their suppliers also producing in the production of the products or services that they're consuming, because they have to aggregate that, and that gets reported out in a company's, you know, emissions report. Because they're reporting it, they're now looking down the supply chain and saying all of their suppliers need to not only capture that data, but for to compress it at the top, you need to compress it all the way through the value chain. So there's encouragement of process change and product change that enables a reduction in overall emissions throughout the value chain. And that's just as it relates to, again, greenhouse gases. That same type of environmental footprint and reduction in environmental footprint is carrying over into the impact on land and the impact on water. And we're seeing that, again, not just top-down, but just opportunity for companies to serve customers, because the customers want this. The customers are demanding it. That's why this intersects really well right now with profitability. Said differently, if you are a supplier to one of these companies and you don't make the changes that are being asked of what your customer is looking for, it's like any other business. If you can't serve your customer and meet the customer where they're at, they're going to find a different supplier. So you're going to lose your green if you're not able to change your practices to meet what your customer needs.
We're talking with Baiju Shaw, CEO of Greater Cleveland Partnership, organizer of tomorrow's Sustainability Summit here in Cleveland. When we look at the opportunity, Baiju, that we have in Northeast Ohio, new leadership at the top of many of our regional organizations and the city and county government, in your mind, has the mayor put enough of a priority on environmental concerns, because he is kind of the leader of the region, business and political?
Well, I think both the mayor and the county executive, who is also new, have both put a significant emphasis on sustainability The three of us together, along with Ron Richard from the Cleveland Foundation and Michael Jeans from Growth Opportunity Partners, actually presented on a panel at the UN Climate Summit back in November in Egypt. And the group of us talked about how we intend to work in partnership between the public sector, the private sector, and the philanthropic sector to really, again, propel ourselves to that vision of a green region on a blue lake.
I think one of the other aspects of the summit is how you're aiming to help companies achieve sustainability goals as it pertains to federal dollars they've taken in. I know because of COVID dollars and the infrastructure bill we've seen, this is something that a lot of organizations did not previously have to deal with.
Yeah, this is, again, I think a catalyst that's really generated even greater acceleration of trends that were already there in the business community. The federal government has in our country, and it's similar, I would say, in other global, other countries around the world, provided significant resources to support companies in this transition and significant incentives for companies that pursue some of these changes in their business practices. Our companies, large and small, are looking at these opportunities. They've come out of things such as the Infrastructure Bill or the Inflation Reduction Act, better known as the Climate Bill. But they're starting to percolate across a broader set of federal opportunities that are coming available. You know, I'll give you one example that's been in the press recently. It's called the Hydrogen Hub. Again, a technical concept, but it's basically creating a new energy source, hydrogen, not a new energy source, but it's capturing an energy source of hydrogen and using it for industrial production. And Ohio has two consortiums that are, have been selected among the 30 to compete for what will probably be 8 to 10 awards to help set up a hydrogen economy infrastructure, which both the federal government as well as the industry believes is an important step forward towards, you know, a more sustainable future.
We mentioned DEI earlier. There are also initiatives out there that require or at least suggest that more companies bring in Black, Latinx, women workers into skilled trades and occupations that for so long in Cleveland were one way only.
Yeah, and I think this is an important element. Again, it intersects our priorities at the Greater Cleveland Partnership, and it's threaded throughout these federal opportunities. Every one of these federal opportunities, Hydrogen Hub included, it's not just about the energy system and the energy value chain. There's an insistence coming from the federal level, which is great because it connects with our values, to make sure that traditionally disadvantaged individuals, whether it's by ethnic background, gender background, foreign-born status, or socioeconomic status, are participating. They're participating in not just workforce programs and skilled trades programs, as you referenced, Rick, but also through business leadership and business ownership. They want to see that there are minority suppliers. Last week, we hosted the Secretary of Commerce at the Greater Cleveland Partnership to talk about our minority business development agency that we operate, not just for the region, but for the state. And she had a chance to meet a number of these companies, not just companies that are participating in the infrastructure, but participating across all types of businesses that are looking to make sure that they participate in the growth of these growth sectors going forward.
Speaking of participation, about roughly 60% of Cleveland's people, 100,000 households, have high energy burdens. This is according to the Mayor's Office of Sustainability. Mm-hmm. More than 40,000 of those households, severe energy burden. How does something like this conference for large businesses and for small businesses impact those folks?
Well, it's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that question. You know, ultimately, high energy burden is a function of high utility cost. So creating more cost-competitive energy sources is probably the answer to reducing the residents' energy burden. It's not a principal focus of our conference this coming week in terms of energy costs, but certainly diversifying energy sources to include more alternative energy sources is on the agenda of a lot of our larger companies. We saw Cleveland Cliffs, as one example, recently enter into a wind power purchase contract where they are purchasing a significant amount of wind energy to ensure that their steel plants, in this case in Northwest Ohio, are being powered by green energy. We expect to see many more companies insisting on more green energy sources to power their operations, again, to meet their broader emissions and environmental goals.
You mentioned Northwest Ohio. I know when you drive through there, you see field after field after field of these tall windmills generating power. And we don't have that here. Is that something that the Greater Cleveland Partnership would like to see more of? And granted, part of it is the structure of the land, but...
Yeah, I think what we want to see is, so if our businesses are looking for something, let's call it energy sources, whether it's wind or solar, and they want to see more green energy sources, we want them to be able to source that locally. We want to make sure that the economic impact of their energy purchases, whether it's from wind energy or solar energy or other types of alternative energy, occur in a local footprint, because it's not only more efficient in terms of the energy transit, but it creates more economic opportunity, more jobs throughout the greater Cleveland area. So we are encouraging of those types of developments throughout our region, because that's what the market is seeking.
Okay. We're kind of teasing people here. The summit tomorrow is sold out. They can't still go as listeners. But if they do want to get in contact with GCP, sustainability work you're doing is something they want to be interested in, where do they go for more info?
Well, there's a couple things. So first, we are going to capture a lot of the summit and curate it so that people who are not able to join us live will be able to at least glean some of the lessons or discussions that occur over at the summit. The second is, you know, from the summit, we're going to be asking for feedback from the attendees on what else we ought to be doing for broader public engagement or broader public interest. And then the third thing is that, you know, with our companies, as I mentioned, the summit was the first initiative, but they're also exploring other collective impact initiatives in the region, again, to make sure that we achieve our air, land, and water goals with our public partners and with our civic partners. And so there will be ways to be involved in all of that. To get more information on it, certainly follow us on social media, whether it's on LinkedIn or Twitter or Instagram or whatever your, you know, form of choice is.
Media of choice, yes.
And then, you know, we'll continue to update our website with further information around different events and different initiatives as they emerge from this summit and other endeavors that we're involved in.
Well, good luck with the conference. Baiju Shah is CEO of Greater Cleveland Partnership. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Rick. Always a pleasure.
Always, again, our thanks to Greater Cleveland Partnership CEO Baiju Shah. Again, they're organizing that Sustainability Summit tomorrow. Highlights at their website as they post content afterward. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, we look at the economic forecast for 2023. Are economists still warning about a recession? What about inflation costs? Will they ever ease? Join us for that discussion tomorrow. To get the last word on today's topic, send an email, soi@ideastream.org. If you missed any portion of this program, please find us online or listen to The Sound of Ideas podcast. You can also hear a rebroadcast of this program tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. I'm Rick Jackson. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.